This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. More than a decade ago, I was a bright-eyed college student sitting in a Women's Studies 101 class learning about feminist history. It was taught to me using the metaphor of ocean waves. The first focused on voting and property rights, the second on equal protection under the law and abortion, and the third on intersectionality. These waves of feminism, these ocean waves, were described as crashing, then retreating, making it almost appear like ideas came out of nowhere and eclipsed everything that came before. A new book takes this version of a linear feminist history and turns it on its head. Through oral history interviews with contemporary feminist activists in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, it explores the constant push and pull within the feminist movement, and how the definition of what a feminist is constantly evolving and not always that relevant to making real social progress. Author Rachel Seidman spoke to 25 activists around the country, and through their interviews, many common questions emerge. Rachel is the director of the Southern Oral History Program and an adjunct assistant professor of history and women's and gender studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her new book is Speaking of Feminism, Today's Activists on the Past, Present, and Future of the U.S. Women's Movement. Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I had such a blast reading this book. I was a women's studies major myself, so there was a lot that I related to, but one of the things that really struck me was in my experience with oral history, it has always been a tool to learn about the past. Mm-hmm. I've never really taken a deep dive into oral histories that are really tracking the present. Mm-hmm. So tell me a bit about your choice to use oral history as a medium for exploring contemporary issues in the feminist movement.
Well, I really also mostly thought about oral history as a way to learn about the past. But it was actually when I was working at Duke and my students started this Who Needs Feminism campaign. And that really introduced me to this whole world of online feminist activism, which I hadn't been very aware of. And that made me want to turn the tool of oral history onto what was going on around me at that very moment. I knew oral history was such a powerful way to ask people to reflect on the work that they had done and the meaning that they made out of that in their lives. And I just thought, well, we could use that with people who are still doing the work today.
Tell me about the Who Needs Feminism campaign and how that all got started.
Well, this was a thing that grew out of a class that I was teaching at Duke on the history and theory and practice of women's leadership. And so at the end of that class, after we had studied all of the different ways that women had practiced activism in the past and practiced leadership, I asked my students to work as a group and try to actually make change on some issue that they could come to consensus on. And what the students at that point decided they really wanted to focus on was actually opening up a kind of rhetorical space on campus to talk about feminism, because they felt that even though we could have great conversations in class, when they went outside of class and tried to have those same conversations, they were basically told to shut up and go away. We don't need feminism anymore. So they came up with this great idea for they took just an old-fashioned whiteboard and a black marker, and they had people fill out the sentence, "I need feminism because," and that people would fill it out however they wanted, and then they took pictures of them, and they got those pictures turned into big posters, which they plastered Duke's campus with, and they wrote this great op-ed about why they were doing this that ran in the newspaper that day. And what happened was they were very successful in opening up a conversation on Duke's campus, and then they put these pictures online, and it literally went viral. I mean, I don't know. I've never actually watched something go viral, but we were watching the little numbers on the Facebook page, you know, just spinning up and up and up and up. And people started sending in their own Who Needs Feminism pictures, literally from around the world. So we were getting pictures from Saudi Arabia and, you know, New Zealand, all over the place.
Let's listen to a quick clip of one of the women that you interviewed in this book. She was in your class at the time. Her name is Ivana Gonzalez, and she is talking about this movement, this Who Needs Feminism movement, and what happened.
That first night when it blew up.
What do you mean it blew up?
The pictures were just flooding in, and our Facebook wall was just being overtaken with both really positive things of people who were just inspired and amazed by how great it was, but also people saying really horrible things. The posters had on Duke's campus, some of them had been defaced, and posters that said "Make me a sandwich" had gone up. We decided to put the pictures up on the Facebook page to show like how bad it was, how bad the negative reaction was. And I remember I had this huge paper due the day that happened, and I was in the basement of my boyfriend's dorm hitting refresh like every second. And I think I cried because I was so panicked. I was like, something bad is going to happen. Like, one of these nutcases is going to hurt somebody.
That was Ivana Gonzalez, deputy director at Blueprint NC, talking about the Who Needs Feminism movement she started while at Duke University. And that interview is included in the book Speaking of Feminism, Today's Activists on the Past, Present, and Future of the U.S. Women's Movement. I'm here with its author, Rachel Seidman, who's also the director of the Southern Oral History Program, where you can find all of these interviews. So I remember seeing that movement explode online. And one thing that really struck me about listening to Ivana talk about it and thinking about it is this interesting tension that emerges with the online feminist movement, where you can make really quick advances in getting people to talk about something and getting people to open up and have a conversation around a certain message. But you also open yourself up to the world of the internet, which has trolls. It has people who feel like they can express whatever they want. And so feminists online are confronted very readily and often silenced by some of these people. So tell me about online activism and feminism and many ways it manifests that you explore a lot in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really powerful quote from Ivana. And it was just kind of a quick vision of what I was to learn later, that we experienced with Who Needs Feminism, what feminist activists all around the country experience on a daily basis, and this, the power of the resistance and the sort of backlash against what they do, and the people who spend many hours of their day simply setting out to shut women up, any woman who tries to have an opinion in the public sphere, and that was that was one of the things that Who Needs Feminism really opened my eyes to, because I hadn't been so aware of that before. And the feminists that I talk to are really, they talk about this kind of double-edged sword, like you were saying, that it's such a powerful tool, and they had so many hopes for how it would open up a new way for people who maybe didn't have a very big soapbox before to add their voices to a public discussion. But that the incredible violence and sort of scary stuff that happens when you do that also has the power to shut that down, and to silence people, and that actually handling misogyny online has become a whole new front in the in the feminist movement. It's a whole kind of side of feminist activism where people are trying to figure out how do we get the different platforms to deal with this misogyny in new ways. And that has become a real focal point for feminist activists that obviously didn't exist 20, 30 years
ago. Well, it's interesting because it's all connected to this idea of, what happens when women have power, what happens when they have access to the ability to say what they want on the internet, when their intellect isn't taken up by, being oppressed by diet culture and all these things. So it's all related, but I feel like it does kind of take a different frame to be able to see what the online space kind of brings up for feminist activists in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Another interview I really want to talk about is your conversation with Rebecca Traister. She's a feminist journalist, has written a lot of recent books, one about women's anger recently. And she brings up this really interesting internal battle within the feminist movement about language, specifically surrounding trans-exclusionary language. So I want to listen to a clip of your conversation with Rebecca Traister.
They feel different ways about language. I've seen this, a few years ago there were big fights about cisgender and language around transgender rights. Activists saying, you have to use these words. If you don't use these words, you are betraying feminism and trans rights. And journalists saying, for my job, the use of these words is not useful right now. It's the activist's job to get the words into the culture, and then I can use them. I can explain what they mean, but to simply throw them in stories alienates readers rather than brings them in if I want to write about trans rights. The activist saying, that's crazy, you're silencing me because you're not using the words that I choose, and the journalist saying, we can't do our jobs if there's an insistence that we use activist language, where our jobs are not to use activist language. I mean, that's an instance I can think of. Now, lo and behold, several years later, I think that the activists have done exactly what activists do, which is work the words into the language. I would now not blink about using cisgender in a piece.
That was feminist journalist Rebecca Traister. Her interview is included in the new book, Speaking of Feminism, Today's Activists on the Past, Present, and Future of the U.S. Women's Movement. Its author, Rachel Seidman, is with me today. She's the director of the Southern Oral History Program, where all of those interviews and many more are housed. So I found this so interesting because as someone who was a women's studies major and then moved out into the working world of journalism, I found there to be a lot of moments of tension between this activist idea that I had in my head and what was really happening in practice. On the radio, you're trying to explain things to people in the most simple terms you can, use language that people understand. So always talking about cisgender people or being very explicit about terms that activists want you to use just does not work. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about how you explored this transition from activist spaces into the working world that many of your interviewees negotiate.
Well, what Rebecca was talking about was the space of online feminism is a place where you have people entering in from many different perspectives. And so some are coming from the activist world and some are coming from the journalist world. And so you have bloggers and you have, journalists like her and activists using Twitter and other things. And so she was really talking about how, on the one hand, that's fantastic because more people, you don't have to have a column in The New Yorker or something in order to have a really big platform. But at the same time, all of those people being in one conversation together has sometimes led to these conflicts because they're coming at it from different perspectives. And so she was using that as a way to explain both the power of this open platform and how it can lead to some conflict. And as I recall in that conversation, we were talking about one thing that other people have talked about is the level of conflict that you see within online feminism. And when I was doing these interviews, most of which were done between 2014 and 2016, was a particularly kind of, I think, tense moment in online feminism. And there was a lot of kind of infighting. And a lot of my interviewees were exploring together where that was coming from and why they thought that was happening and kind of what it meant.
One of your interviewees said something interesting, which was in response to seeing something that another online feminist says that she didn't agree with. She said it's better to reach out privately mm-hmm. than to attack them publicly mm-hmm. on that platform. That was striking to me. And I'm curious about what you learned about conflict within the feminist movement that surprised you and maybe where that conflict is bubbling up most today.
Well, one of the things that I really appreciated about being able to do these long interviews with people was whereas the newspapers, newspaper articles love to focus on conflict and particularly conflict between women, a cat fight always seems to be a good story. Twitter, if you look on Twitter, it's full of conflict. But when I sat down with people to do these long interviews where they really got a chance to reflect and got a chance to talk about what had possibly led to some conflict or how it had affected them and what they thought about it now, it really gave people a chance to dive deeper. And what I found was that really, yes, there was some defensiveness and there was some anger and there were some hurt feelings and things. But mostly, these were incredibly thoughtful, generous, people who were trying their hardest to figure out how do we build an inclusive movement. And what Emily May is the one who said that you were referring to, you know, you shaming someone and kind of attacking them is publicly may very well lead them to say, well, forget this, I'm out of here. And that you want to educate people. She said, you know, I will call them up and say, hey, that thing you said, you know, wasn't good for these reasons. But it's about educating people and helping them learn and grow in the movement, not sort of publicly shaming them and getting them to leave the movement. And that I found really powerful, that a lot of these women were talking about, you know, too many people are focused on building their own personal brand rather than on building the movement. And I really, I found that powerful. And the ones that I interviewed were really concerned about how do we help people learn and grow and stay in the movement together.
So looking at this current, if we're using the wave metaphor, this current post-third wave, fourth wave time, what do you feel like are some of the biggest issues that emerge through your interviews that feminists are really focusing on, working toward at this current moment? And what strategies are they trying to use to reach certain goals?
Well, one thing I'll say is that most of the people I interviewed kind of reject the wave metaphor. Mm-hmm. They don't find it helpful. You were saying you had learned it in school, and they say, yeah, it's, we can understand why it's helpful in school if you need sort of a timeline kind of thing. But again, when you're building a movement, sort of saying, oh, you're second wave and you're third wave, all that does is divide us. And they were saying, you know, that's not a very useful way of thinking about things. So I backed away from, none of them claim to be fourth wave or anything like that. And I don't really use that language in there. I love Nancy Hewitt's, she's a historian, and her way of talking about, we need to reframe this as radio waves, which is appropriate for today, but not things that kind of crash and recede, but that stay on in different, and some are stronger and some are weaker, but they're always there with us. I think what really impressed me about these women, mostly women, there was one trans man in the book, what they were working on was the breadth of all of the things that they were working on. So some were really involved in reproductive justice movements, which is basically trying to expand the notion beyond reproductive rights, being focused on the right to, say, access to abortion or the right to birth control, to a broader framework of reproductive justice, which says, you know, we also need to be able to raise the children that we do have in peace,
yeah,
and with the resources that we need to do so, you know, in good health. Others were working on, you know, trying to get the media to stop kind of hyper-sexualizing young girls. Others were working on this notion of, you know, how do we deal with online feminist how do we deal with misogyny online, and how can we work with media companies to go against that? But there was just such a huge range of the things that they were working on. And what was most interesting to me in many ways was how they were drawing connections between all of these.
All right. I wish we had more time, plenty more to explore in the book. Speaking of Feminism, Today's Activists on the Past, Present, and Future of the U.S. Women's Movement. I've been talking with its author, Rachel Seidman. She's the director of the Southern Oral History Program and an adjunct assistant professor of history and women's and gender studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.